Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons. Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Hello.
That's Vanessa over there.
Hello.
I'm Kelly. Eric, when you walked in today, I was watching Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yes.
And I was watching it because, I don't know if you guys pay attention to the news, but the kid who played Short Round, Kei Hoi Kwan, he is out there now in these interviews having to defend Temple of Doom as a racist film, and was Spielberg racist doing this kind of stuff. And I just get so angry about this stuff, because here he is. He's been out of the limelight for a long time, probably feeling pretty good about everything, everywhere, all at once.
Yeah.
And then he gets asked to basically be the spokesperson for something that he, you know.
How old was he when they made that movie?
He was like
10 years old.
Yeah.
And also, in the interview, he's like, all I know is Spielberg put a ton of Asians to work in that film, and I don't see how that could be that bad and stuff like this. But can we just get past this shit? Why does anybody have to be the spokesperson for their race?
Some people choose to, and if you want to, that's fine. Go forward and do that. But it's weird, the idea of forcing people to defend. It's weird to look at stuff through modern eyes while watching stuff from 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And trying to pretend you have figured out what was meant by somebody that may not even be alive anymore.
Right.
And sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong, but this venomous need to attack or defend whatever is bugging you or whatever you think is stupid. Chill, man.
Yeah.
Movies.
And it's always like so cherry picked too. Cause I'm like, nobody's out there like talking about how awful Miss Congeniality was. That movie is awful. As far as like it's all, you know, fear of homosexuality, and it's disgusting, some of the stuff they say. But that's a movie from a time in which we did not think about the things that we were saying in that way. And now it's different. And it's like people are really cherry picking these very obvious moments and movies to attack. And it's so old. Like, come on, just focus on the now. Let's be better people now.
There's also the fun of the pure joy of that photo. I'm sure you saw of him seeing Harrison Ford again and them hugging. And that photo is just like, that's awesome.
Oh,
yeah.
So good.
This is not a man who was belittled and made to feel like shit on set.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It sticks in my craw.
Cool. What's a craw? Like a crawdad? Do you have a pet crawdad?
Vanessa, I love you. Never change.
He's running around like, get the stick off me.
You guys, I watched the best DC movie that is out right now.
Ooh, okay.
It's called League of Super Pets. It's on HBO Max.
I have seen this.
I was wondering if that
was
good.
With The Rock as Crypto and Kevin Hart as, he's not Bat Dog or anything, but he's going to become Bat Dog by the end of the movie. It was delightful.
Aww.
It was very funny and cute. The animation was just right for a superhero-ish kind of thing. Yeah. I mean, it's not realistic animation. I was like, why can't DC figure out that, you know, let's just focus on our animation studio that seems to be knocking it out of the park. I also watched the Battle of the Super Sons or something like that, which is Superboy and Robin teaming up and having to save the world. And it was also really fun and well done. And it's just like, okay, you guys have figured this out on a small scale.
They are so locked into gritty. Like, you have one character that fits that. Wonder Woman and Superman and Green Lantern and The Flash and on and on and on do not necessarily need to be insulted into grit and grime in everything they do. Batman, sure.
Yeah.
But in fact, and that is such a fun, lighthearted movie that hits all those notes, like him out sitting out on the curb being the little guard dog.
Yes.
Just, it's so good.
Well, and also it's about, you know, crypto and this group of pets that all have superpowers, and it's kind of silly. But Batman and the Flash and Wonder Woman are also in it, and mm-hmm. Batman is hilarious because he's so broody and stuff like yeah. that. So I thought it was just really, really fun, and I don't think anybody's talking about it. So
yeah. Yeah, I think the Lego Batman movie was probably one of my favorite DC films, too.
For sure.
Well, I finally, now that we're in November and it's not October and I'm not trying to watch a bunch of horror films, watched and caught up on Andor. So I've completed nice. Andor. I loved it.
I wouldn't go that far, it. But there were episodes that I absolutely loved, like the Prison Break episode.
Oh my God, the Prison Break is so good.
That might be the finest hour of Star Wars since Disney took over Star Wars.
It's just incredible. Like the amount of tension that they build using limited resources in limited space and limited characters. Every time the old man is trying to like put together a mechanical thing, I'm like, oh my God, don't get hurt. Oh, and like, just, you know, watching, okay, I've got a few minutes in the bathroom. I'm going to whittle away at this like pipe, and all these little things still feel so big.
Yeah.
And that's a incredible achievement.
And I thought that final episode mm-hmm. was a real banger. I was, you know, on the yeah. edge of my seat for that.
Oh, so. Completely. And you're just like, where are you going? Like, what is happening? Like, oh, it's so good. But yeah, there were a couple of episodes in the sort of beginning that I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a little bored. I'm not sure. But then once we started getting into like Jailbreak, and there's a lot of heist-ish episodes, just really incredible.
It should have been, I wish it had been called something different, because it's really not so much about Andor, it's about the seeds of rebellion.
Yeah.
And there's so many.
There you go.
Other.
Seeds of rebellion.
Well, yeah, there's so many other little spokes going off and what it requires and the sacrifice that it requires to do something like this. And I thought that those stories were at least as interesting and more interesting than some of the Andor stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
Not interested at all?
Oh, no, I do. Should, I do okay. want to see it.
I will say, I think anytime that Star Wars, I think this is true now, if they make a show that isn't Obi-Wan or isn't Boba Fett or some other character we all know already, and yeah. it's just something where they're like, yeah, I guess, I don't know, you want to tell this story, whatever, go for it, we don't care. It's so much better.
With the same thing we were saying with Marvel last episode, exactly. You get these sidebar things that yeah. are something new that the writers can dig their teeth into and don't have to worry about. Okay, here's your 5,000 book about what you need to make sure you follow
exactly.
for our next 12 movies coming up or some shit like that.
Yeah.
Right. That was the thing that pissed me off with Obi-Wan. You know, we see that in A New Hope, Vader saying, you know, I sense a presence I haven't felt since. And you assume it's the last time they fought. But now we can just put in them fighting a bunch of last times.
True.
And I don't like that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Oof.
Well, I saw one that was really fucking dumb.
Oh, okay.
One of those that at the time it came out sort of was a culture moment kind of thing that I just never bothered to see and Dina hadn't seen, and we're seemed to be in the right altered state to enjoy. Dude, Where's My Car?
Oh, wow. I have not seen this either.
You're fine.
And Dad?
Yeah, that part is funny as hell. There are the moments where you go, oh, though that's where those lines came from. And then, and a few other scenes. But wow. It just, there are parts that are really funny. And there are parts that are just really boring.
It's
kind of silly.
What's my tattoo say? Dude, what's mine? Sweet.
See those little moments. It gets really weird, too.
Yeah, at the end which is kinda, not what you're expecting the story to go towards.
Exactly, which I did kind of like, but, you know, they're one-dimensional
It's a stoner comedy. I don't know that that it's a stoner comedy for adults.
Right. If you're in high school and enjoying something you shouldn't be enjoying because you're underage. But anyways, you probably might like this a lot.
That's Ashton Kutcher?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's his name from the American Pie movies?
Right. And The Rundown with The Rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy.
Something Michael something or something like that. I watched the first couple episodes of Tulsa King, which is Sylvester Stallone's new series.
I keep getting advertised that, but I have not seen it.
Good.
Yeah, it's really good, except when he is required to act in quotations. He's got some scenes where it's requiring some real emotion. And he's not quite there. But otherwise, it's funny, and there are some kind of touching things. And I think Stallone looks great for 75-year-old.
Yeah, that's true.
I will keep watching it. It's mobster stuff. It feels a little bit like a kind of violent My Blue Heaven.
That's what I was going to ask. Is it like that film? Okay.
Yeah, because he's been in prison for 20 years, and he thinks he's going to be given, you know, part of the family to run, and instead they send him to Tulsa, Oklahoma to pretty much just get rid of him. And so he gets up to his shenanigans in Tulsa.
There you go.
Fun promise, but I don't love gangster stuff.
So. Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Which thing to talk about? So many fun things. So I did actually watch, was it Resident Evil? I think it's 2 or 3.
Your husband moving you forward through this series?
Sure is. Sure is. Sometimes I look down and I look up and there's a disc going in the player and I'm like, what is this? And he's like, just sit back and watch. I did say in my vows, I did promise to watch all of the bad Resident Evil movies.
That is true.
So I did see both 2 and 3.
Man, that is love.
Doing my best. But I will say, I think it's 3. There is a great bird scene in that film that he told me you should, for your bird episode, do this film. And I was like, that's a stupid idea. And I ignored him and I regret it because that would have been so much better than
Condor,
the vulture.
Or vulture.
Oh, I
think that was 3.
I think it was 3.
Yeah.
Where they're like Mad Maxing it through the desert.
Yes. And zombie crows.
Yep. And they've got the clone pile, the clone trench of dead girls.
Yeah. That's one of the few I've seen. I haven't seen most of the series, but I have seen that one.
It was pretty good. Yeah. It was pretty fun. Yeah. I was wondering because they murder the love interest in a very heroic way. I was like, is this because the lead is now banging the guy who's writing and kind of directing these? Is that why the love interest for her character, who is essentially becoming asexual, is suddenly gone? Interesting.
Now, I don't remember exactly how many Resident Evil movies there are, but does he have them all and you will watch them all?
There is a box set. I don't know how many are in it. I guess I'll find out. I mean, I've already seen the one in the theaters, Raccoon City, and I haven't seen the TV show.
Oh, man, I made it through one episode of the TV show.
I've heard such bad things. But you know what? It's fine. It's so nonsensical. And, like, it's fine. I've played enough of the games that I'm like, okay, cool. I know who this character is. I know what they're doing here. Okay, this makes sense for that. Gotcha. I remember fighting that monster. That it's, like, engaging enough. It's fun. It's not going to be Tremors 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6.
It's sort of like that weird period we went through where we're both watching all the Death Race movies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're not great, but they are a lot of fun to watch.
Sure. Yeah,
exactly.
And way more fun than the Resident Evil movies.
So another 90s film that want to rewatch on, sure, which holds up quite well, is Get Shorty.
I keep hearing that's an incredible movie, but not, just the poster just gets me. I just can't get past it.
That's just a stupid 90s poster.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't think this is your kind of movie, Vanessa.
Oh, okay. Then maybe
it's a little noirish.
A little mobsterish.
The only thing that might appeal to you is Travolta plays this character that just loves the movies. I mean, loves them. Doesn't understand them at all, but quickly figures out exactly what it means to be a producer. And it's one of his better roles. He's really fun in it. He's really got his natural cool that he used to have fully intact in this film.
Nice.
Danny DeVito's fun. And it's a fun film with and it's also kind of silly. So there's a lot of things against it for you.
But it might be so many things against it that it just happens to be great.
Oh, I love it exactly. When somebody says, it's just crazy enough to work.
Exactly. Yes.
You never know. Sometimes.
Oh, very enjoyable film.
Cool.
Nice. How about we take a break, you guys? And then when we come back, we're going to talk Alfred Hitchcock.
Welcome to Universal Studios, where you learn Hollywood secrets. And now you'll learn the secrets of the $6 million man and the bionic woman on the Universal Studios tour.
We have returned, you guys. This was my subgenre choice. We're talking Alfred Hitchcock films. I'm going to put 10 minutes on the board, and I'm going to talk about... Frenzy.
I dare say you are wondering why I am floating around London like this. I am on the famous Thames River, investigating a murder. Rivers can be very sinister places, and in my new film, Frenzy, this river, you may say, was the scene of a very horrible murder.
It's a woman!
Another necktie murder.
Of course, one can never be sure where danger lurks. They tell me a dreadful crime was committed right in this building. My investigation next led me to this innocent alley, of which there are hundreds in London. But I don't think we should stay long. Something unpleasant is about to happen. Here is the scene of another horrible murder. This is the famous London wholesale fruit and vegetable market, Covent Garden. Here you may buy the fruits of evil and the horrors of vegetables. I've heard of a leg of lamb, a leg of chicken, but never a leg of potatoes.
What's wrong?
Look, she's wearing my tie. How do you like my tie? How do you like it?
...1972. Have you guys seen this movie?
I have.
This is a first-time viewing for me.
Oh, my goodness.
Budget of $2 million. Box office of $12.6 million. Rotten Tomatoes critics have it at 90%, and the audience has it at 78%. Directed by Sir Alfred Hitchcock. 69 directing credits, 29 producing credits, 31 writing credits and 38 actor credits, all of them uncredited, ironically, and with names like Silhouette at Office of Vital Statistics, uh-huh, or Man in Wheelchair, or, in this movie, Spectator at Opening Rally. It was written by Anthony Schaefer, who has 13 writing credits, including Murder on the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, and The Wicker Man, mm-hmm, and was based on the novel by Arthur LaBerne. Starring John Finch, 66 credits, including The Vampire Lovers, The Martian Chronicles, and Lurking Fear. Barry Foster, who has 110 credits, mostly British TV and TV movies, but he was also Inspector Clouseau in the movie Inspector Clouseau, which is a horrible Pink Panther sequel without Peter Sellers. And he was in Twisted Nerve and The Battle of Britain. And it also stars Barbara Leigh Hunt, 63 credits, including Oh Heavenly Dog, Billy Elliot, and was a voice in The Plague Dogs, one of the feel-bad cartoon movies of all time.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Oh, do not watch The Plague Dogs.
Just don't.
So we start out at an outdoor news conference that is suddenly interrupted by someone noticing a dead woman floating to the shore of the Thames River. She's completely naked, except for a necktie around her neck, which she has been strangled with. And someone shouts, it's the necktie killer. And then we are immediately introduced to our lead, who is tying his own necktie around his neck as he gets ready to go to work. And it's a really nice scene because it immediately makes you think, this guy is obviously the killer, right? This is Richard Blaney, who is an ex-RAF squadron leader, but now down on his luck bartender. And he gets fired from that job immediately as soon as he gets to work because he gets caught taking a couple of shots from the whiskey taps. The taps back in the 70s must have been pretty cool because they measure out into a little glass bubble an exact shot.
Oh, no, they still do that.
Do they still do that?
Yeah, okay. That's why I got blasted the first time I came to America.
Oh, yes. Because I was like, wow, I am so used to just free pour. And then if you go to a place where they start to know you and they know you tip well, they just pour and pour and pour. Yeah.
Never in a million years.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, Richard, who gets fired, meets with his buddy, Bob Rusk, and tells him how bad his life has become. And Rusk gives him a tip on the upcoming horse race, but Blaney has no money. Just as he's there, a cop comes over to talk to Rusk. And when Rusk turns to introduce his friend, Blaney is mysteriously gone as if he did not want to meet the police, right? So then he goes to visit his ex-wife, Brenda, who runs a very successful matchmaking agency, and gets into a loud fight with her, which her assistant overhears. And he storms out and spends the night in a Salvation Army. And as he's taking off his jacket, he slips his hand in his pocket and finds out that his ex had slipped him some money. So, and his ex seems like a really nice lady. She's successful, but she's had enough of his shit. And this is, you know, a very, it's a very relatable person. This movie is interesting in that it doesn't quite feel Hitchcockian. I mean, there's some elements of it that get to that point, but the characters are more likable than you normally get in a Hitchcock film.
Sure.
Except for one. So, meanwhile, his buddy Rusk goes and visits Brenda, his friend's ex-wife, and we find out that he was already turned away from the matchmaking agency because he's a fucking creep. And since Brenda is alone there, he decides it's raping time and then takes his tie off and strangles her with it. Dun, dun, dun!
Oh, no!
He's the necktie killer, not Blaney. However, after he leaves, Blaney shows up to apologize to his ex. He finds the door to her office is locked, so he just leaves. But her assistant, who is coming back from lunch, she sees him leaving. Then she goes and unlocks the door, finds her boss dead, and immediately puts it together that since Blaney just left, he must be the killer, right? So from here, it's a story of Blaney trying to avoid the police and Rusk realizing he can pin all of these murders on his friend if he plays his cards correctly. And there's even a great scene where Blaney turns to Rusk for help because he doesn't know that Rusk is the killer. And so Rusk is like setting him up to take all of this, to take the fall for all of this. There's a prison break scene that is pretty great and a scene where Rusk is stowed away on a truck carrying a bunch of bags of potatoes. And he's trying to get to a dead body that he had hid in a bag of potatoes because he realizes the victim had taken his tie pin from him. And so he has to stow away on this bag of potatoes, get through the potatoes, find her, and find her hand, which he does. She's gripping his tie pin. And then, of course, the rigor mortis has set in, so he can't get it. So he's breaking her fingers.
Oh, wow.
And it's like a really, it's a really gruesome scene and not what I was expecting from a Hitchcock film. And then there is a climax to this film that is incredibly anticlimactic and super disappointing. So, but it's literally the only disappointing part of the film, but it's kind of like the most important part. You don't want to fuck that up.
Mm.
I will just say this. I really enjoyed this movie. Mostly, I was just surprised at how sleazy it was. This is a uncharacteristically sleazy film for Hitchcock, and it's in the 70s, so I wonder what he's thinking. The rape scene is uncomfortable as hell, but mostly because you realize that Rusk is impotent. So he's raping her through his pants. You know, there's no removal of clothing, which makes it even creepier, you know, because she realizes at some point that she is being raped, but there is no penetration. And it just kind of focuses on her eyes staying open while she's, you know, just silently accepting this.
Woof. Woof.
There is some nudity in this, which surprised me. But I will just say, big, big thumbs up. This was Alfred Hitchcock's 52nd movie.
Wow.
Is that?
Damn.
I mean, that is crazy.
Whew.
Dame Helen Mirren was Sir Alfred Hitchcock's first choice to play Barbara Milligan. And she is the one that gets raped and everything. Mm-hmm. And she met with Hitchcock before turning down the role, which several years later she said she regretted very much.
Hmm.
Several of the cast was unhappy with the lack of authenticity and Britishness of some of the dialogue. John Finch used to send notes to Hitchcock's secretary with suggested improvements. Hitchcock was not always pleased with this.
Oh, I bet.
He wrote back to him, "John, I said you could make alterations. I didn't say you could rewrite the whole script." However, many of Finch's script amendments were used in the final cut. So, yeah, a real departure, it felt like to me. But again, my Hitchcock knowledge ends at the ones that everybody has seen. North by Northwest, The Birds, Psycho, stuff like that. This is the kind of movie I actually really love, especially lately. It's super sleazy. It's London in 1972. Everything is so dirty. In fact, the entire press conference at the beginning is how they're going to clean up the river and there won't be pollutants floating down. And then here comes this dead body. and I was like, oh, this movie is way funnier than I thought it would be, but it is really, really black humor.
Yeah.
I beat my timer by a lot, so I'm just going to turn it off by at least 2 minutes, you guys.
Wow.
There it is. But Vanessa, I want to hear your thoughts on this since you actually saw it.
I wonder if he is a lot more sleazy and open with some of those grosser elements because the Hays Code is gone at this point by, what, maybe 4 years?
That's a good point. Yeah. I also wonder if it's just, this is the first time he's shot in Britain since the 50s.
Oh, my God,
and
yeah.
It's got to be so much sleazier over there at this point that maybe he's just like, well, I'm going to absolutely embrace this.
Yeah, I think there is something to that. I also remember the thing that stuck out the most to me is the lead is a budget Michael Caine. They clearly wanted Michael Caine.
In fact, I found that. I didn't put that in there. He gave the script to Michael Caine, and Michael Caine was like, no.
Yeah, because the guy kind of looks like him and sounds exactly like him. You're just like, oh, too bad.
Yeah.
Too busy with those classy titles like Alfie, yeah.
It's so funny that you mentioned that, too, because I just watched Oliver Stone's The Hand. Have you seen that, Eric?
I haven't.
It's really bad. Yeah, and it's Michael Caine in a really, really bad movie. And I then watched this movie and saw that he had turned this down because it was too sleazy and he didn't like how horrible the killer was.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, oh, you've made some really bad choices in your life. This might have been a better one.
I really didn't think he turned down much of anything, much less something with an A-list director like that.
I think he was at the height of his power at that point, though. And, you know, people change.
Yeah,
maybe they're like, hey, I'm a little more desperate and a little more excited to do these horrible films.
Also, though, I think he did Get Carter this year, Michael Caine, in 72. And that's a great movie.
Right.
So maybe he just had really good scripts coming his way.
Nice.
It would make sense. I mean, yeah, and Hitchcock probably was on his way down. He was probably becoming unfashionable. So.
Right. Yeah. Okay, Vanessa, are you ready?
Yes.
Setting the timer. And go.
Okay. Oh. Ah. All right. So I chose a film. I've seen a lot of Hitchcock movies as well. So I wanted to choose one I hadn't seen, which I went with Shadow of a Doubt from 1943. Die.
Do you know if you ripped the fronts off houses, you'd find swine?
I don't want you to touch my mother. So go away, I'm warning you. Go away or I'll kill you myself. Your hands! Let me go, Uncle Charlie! Let me go!
It had a lot of people being like, this sounds kind of good. And so I was like, all right, I'll check it out. Has 100% from critics and 89% from audience.
Nice.
I also wonder if that's just because people are like, I can't give Hitchcock a bad review in hindsight. Budget unknown. Box office, $1.2 million. Also financially, I believe, not good. Maybe I'll find out in the trivia. Directed, of course, by Alfred Hitchcock, which we have already talked about here. But the one thing I will point out is he did The Birds, the good one. The good one that was the only bird movie maybe you should watch.
Did you actually get Land's End?
I did. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I did get it. Written by Thornton Wilder, who has 80 credits, including Hello, Dolly, Our Town, The Bridge of San Luray. Sally Benson, who wrote Anna and the King of Siam, Meet Me in St. Louis, The Singing Nun, and contributed to the film Little Women. And Alma Reville, who has written quite a few of Hitchcock's pieces, including Suspicion, The 39 Steps, The Lady Vanishes, and The Ring. Not that one.
That's his wife, isn't it? Alma?
I think so. You're right. I couldn't quite remember what her name was, and I kept looking for her. She didn't direct, she didn't edit this one. And I was like, oh, okay. I thought his wife edited, but maybe not. Starring Teresa Wright as Charlie Newton. She's been in 87 Things. This was her fourth feature film. She went on to be in The Best Years of Our Lives, Mrs. Miniver, The Little Foxes, and The Pride of the Yankees. Joseph Cotten as Uncle Charlie, 134 credits, including The Third Man, Citizen Kane, Gaslight, and Soylent Green. And MacDonald Carey as Jack Graham, 117 credits, including Let's Make It Legal, Suddenly It's Spring, and 3,071 episodes of Days of Our Lives.
Wow.
Dr. Tom Horton.
Oh, Lord.
So I was like, this guy looks kind of familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. And I'm like, all right, I think I know who you are. The story follows Charlie is lying on his bed alone in a rented room in a terrible part of town, Philadelphia. You know it's really bad because there's a bunch of kids in the street kicking a can. My God. He's staring up the ceiling, wishing for death. He's deeply depressed about something. His landlady comes in to tell him that were two men were looking for him, but she sent them away. She then notices he has thousands of dollars on the floor nearby him. She kind of picks them up and stacks them together and puts them on the side and says, you shouldn't just leave this stuff laying around. And then she closes the blinds to let him get some sleep. She's the nicest landlady ever. And he says, you know what? Maybe I should just let the guys get me. And she's like, okay, Sonny. Instead, he gets an idea. He calls and telegrams his family in California to let them know that he is going to make a trip over there. He heads out. The two men follow him very quickly on his trail. And of course, we get this really classic Hitchcock, you know, one goes one way, one goes the other. And you see that they lose him and he's up on the roof watching them from afar. So he loses them. He catches a train and pretends to be sick on the train. I don't know why. Never mind. Gets to Santa Rosa, California, where young Charlotte Newton, Charlie for short, named after her uncle, is sitting around. Meanwhile, not at the same time. She's sitting around sad and depressed. She feels like her life is nothing. Boredom has crept in. It's taking over her, not only her, but her whole family. And she decides the only way to shake things up is to invite her Uncle Charlie over to come and visit. And of course, at the exact same moment, she gets the telegram saying that he is coming. She feels a deep connection to her uncle. Not only is she named after him, but she kind of feels like he's sort of a twin to her. They're very closely connected. So when he arrives, they are glued to each other at the hip. They're constantly holding hands. They're walking together. There's a lot of looking at each other. It's okay. She's 16. I'm sure it's fine. However, small clues start to seep in that things are not totally okay. Her uncle is occasionally becomes really dark. He starts to go on like weird little rants. He talks about how elderly women who are widowed are fat, wheezing animals. He hides a newspaper article that Charlie notices, and she kind of reads through to try and figure out what the article is that he is so worried about them seeing. And he gives her a ring that has a strange inscription on it that's clearly not for her. When two men come to do a census of the house and interview all the family members for a fun newspaper story, this really upsets Charlie, and he does not want his photo taken. They take a picture of him, and he requests the film immediately, and they give it to him. Of course, these two men are not actually from the census. Spoiler alert. They are undercover detectives
dun, dun.
On the trail of two different men. So some people are following a lead in the East Coast, and they are following this one on the West Coast because they need to hunt down the Merry Widowmaker. We find this out, like, so one of the detectives is falling hard for Charlie, of course. Don't worry, he's an adult man, and she is 16. It's totally fine. They go out on a date. They show all these cuts to her on the date where it's like a happy picture of her, a happy picture of a happy picture. And then her face is just horrified. It's such a good montage. Charlie is basically, the detective says, you know, hey, there's something going on. Your uncle might be behind it. You please keep an eye on him and let us know if anything happens. And she's like, I thought we were on a date. And he's like, oh, we are, but I have to tell you. So, of course, when Charlie realizes that his niece, Charlie, suspects him, he becomes angry that she doesn't adore him anymore. And suddenly there are a lot of near-death moments for Charlie, the girl, from her uncle, or which could be her uncle. It's hard to say for sure. Will she ever get a second date with the handsome detective, Jack Graham? Will Charlie, the girl, live to see the end of the film? Is Uncle Charlie the Merry Widow Maker? Most of these will be answered long before the final act, but the film will keep going. some thoughts about this film. It was super enjoyable. It was really fun. It did have a bloated third act, but that's okay. The little girl, there's a couple of siblings to Charlie, and there's this little girl, Anna, who's running around with glasses and pigtails, and she's got to be like 8. And she's so sassy and so hilarious. She's like constantly making fun of her mom. Like, mom, you don't have to shout into the telephone. Hello. And like, she's holding, it's like one of those old rotary phones with the like separate mouthpiece that you hold. Yeah. And I'm like, man, and things do not change. This time is just on a repeat. And they make fun of her mom for going out in a dumb straw hat. So embarrassing. The dad is friends with this guy named Herbie, and they're constantly playing this game of how to kill each other. And they're talking about, like, okay, how you would get away with the perfect murder. And they're really into these, like, murder mystery magazines. And so they keep saying, hey, did your tea taste a little weird the other day? No, it tasted fine. Oh, well, it should have. I poured soda in it, but it could have been poison, and then you would have been got. There's just like a lot of this constantly happening about them talking about murdering each other. And the dad is very sure that he would just use a blunt instrument. And it's really great because at one point Charlie's like, you guys have to stop talking about death and murder. And the men are like, no, we're only talking about killing each other. And the mom says, honey, you know this is how your dad likes to relax. It's just so lovely. It has a great use of lighting. Every time Charlie, the man, goes into like a dark, deep place, they kind of change the lighting on him. So you can really like stick with his emotional space, which is great. Catherine, the female friend, is a little horn dog. She is like the best friend of Charlie. And she is like, every time a man shows up in a scene, she looks him up and down. And I'm like, yo, girl, chill a little bit. And you're there. This film does have a lot of very House of Dragon uncle niece vibes going on. I will say it is upsetting. Trivia. Hitchcock often cites this as his favorite movie. It's inspired by the 16-month killing spree of Earl Nelson. Shadow of a Doubt was the script title, but was listed as temporary title until a better one could be found. And this was a box office failure when it was released. So, okay, I wasn't wrong on that. Taglines include a blast of dramatic dynamite exploded right before your eyes. Terror, warning her to kill or be killed. Why do I fear the man I love? He torments me. Am I going mad? And last but not least, Alfred Hitchcock's powerful dramatic love story. I'm like, you guys, this is not a love story. It's an uncle. He's her uncle.
And the 16 you're talking about. Too, for the love story there, yeah.
And there's two guys that are after her. One's an adult man detective. One is an adult man uncle.
Arrest himself later on.
I know, right? No. They're definitely getting married.
My mom had her first kid at 17. I mean, this is how it works.
I know. Although, my grandma did
although,
too.
No, she was with another 17-year-old. So.
Yeah. I guess so. I guess. God, I can't imagine if I'd end up with a person I dated when I was 17.
Oh, jeez.
Holy shit.
The worst.
That would have been weird.
I've never seen this movie.
This
is one of the ones I have not seen.
It's a fun one.
It sounds familiar, but I'm not. Don't think I have either.
You know, there is like the same, there's like three films with this exact same plot. Exactly. So, or similar. It's not always the uncle, but the potential mistaken identity. I will say this is an interesting one because Hitchcock like really decides like, I'm going to go for this one way that this is going to be. And it's not super expected. And I'm like, really? Okay. I guess we're going here. Cool. And not just about the 16-year-old.
Oh, that's good.
You ready, Eric?
Yeah, I believe I am.
All right.
Okay, so I did one of his very different films. 1955's The Trouble with Harry.
Once upon a time, in a quiet little town, some very respectable people got into The Trouble with Harry. John Forsythe, Edmund Gwenn, Mildred Natwick, Shirley MacLaine in her screen debut, and Jerry Mathers are all involved. It's a most unfortunate situation. Because the trouble with Harry is, well, he's dead.
What did I tell you, Mommy?
Touch it, Arnie.
There he is.
Harry, thank Providence, the last of Harry.
He's dead.
Yes. Doesn't live around here.
And he died around here. That's what counts now.
Embarrassing.
Accident, pure and simple. I thought he was a rabbit or a pheasant or something.
I hit him over the head with the milk bottle and knocked him silly. What do you call it?
Dead. It ain't mine.
After all, I killed him.
You see, we don't know quite what to do with Harry. Thought you might have some suggestions.
You can stuff him for all I care. Stuff him and put him in a glass case. Only I'd suggest frosted glass.
Come on, Miller.
I only brought up your name once when we were talking about strange people.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Hey, what's he doing in our bathtub?
It's a delightful little romantic comedy that just happens to revolve around a corpse. Alfred Hitchcock presents The Trouble with Harry. You'll want to get into it.
Oh, sure.
I have seen this one. I like this movie.
Considered his only true comedy, yeah. Although he's got humor in most of his movies. This did a the Rotten Tomatoes, 88 from the critics, 73 from the crowd. So maybe a little low for Hitchcock. Box office of $3.4 million in the U.S., so it's financial failure here, although it played for a year in England and Rome and a year and a half in France.
Wow.
So it made its money back from the other countries. Director, Alfred Hitchcock. You've heard of him. You know who he is. I wanted to see what his name was after you mentioned his titling for different names. Oh. They called him for things. I wanted to find out what he was called in this one. And he is Man Walking Past Sam's Outdoor Exhibition.
Oh.
Nice.
I did spot him. He's actually way in the background on this one. But, he cuts a distinctive figure. But if you want to learn more about Hitchcock, might I recommend the excellent book, Hitchcock and Truffaut.
Oh, yeah.
Where Francois Truffaut sits down with translator Helen Scott and Alfred Hitchcock and talk for multiple days about filmmaking and the ideas of film and a whole bunch of other shit. I've got the book version and it's huge. It's such a long interview and it's so interesting. So any interest in Hitchcock or Truffaut, actually, read that one. So the writers, Jean-Michel Haze, he wrote the almost guilty pleasure of mine. I haven't seen it enough years to say for sure, but the dog racing movie called Iron Will.
Oh.
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
It's one of those random ones you get at Suncoast. Like, oh, well, this is G, let's play it or whatever. The Man Who Knows, this, he also wrote The Man Who Knows Too Much, Rear Window, and radio dramas of Sam Spade and Inner Sanctum, which great name for that, based on a book by Jack Trevor. And the stars, John Forsythe, who at this time was a relative unknown, but you might know him from In Cold Blood, 220 episodes of Dynasty, Scrooged, 108 episodes of Charlie's Angels, and Topaz. So 103 credits overall, so a lot. This is...
He was the voice of Charlie, wasn't he?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the introduction, first film ever for Shirley MacLaine.
Wow.
Who currently has two movies in production.
Still. Damn, girl.
She was in Ocean's 11, the original, Two Mules for Sister Sarah, The Turning Point, Terms of Endearment, Still Magnolias. Ah. And for this film, she won Golden Globe's Most Promising Newcomer.
Huh?
I don't know if they have that award anymore. Mm. And Edmund Gwenn, who was Santa in The Miracle on 34th Street. He was also in Them. Pride and Prejudice, and of Human Bondage. His first screen appearance was in 1916. And a name you might recognize, Jerry Mathers.
Nice.
The Beaver from Leave It to Beaver.
Oh.
101 episodes of, and 101 episodes of the new Leave It to Beaver.
Whoa.
In the mid-80s or something like that.
No, there was a new Leave It to Beaver.
Watch this on from one of the Blu-ray box sets I got from Amazon. This is really well remastered. It looks so gorgeous. It's shot in, I think, Virginia in the fall. And it's like, damn, fantastic location. Of course, half the movie is also on stage because they had horrible rains and had to build up and go inside. But looks great. Here's some shots ringing out. What's happening? This little weird kid, very weird kid in this movie, runs around and finds a body. Then we move to Edmund, who is a hunter out there talking to himself with the writing in this movie is so good. The lines like he shoots three times or something like that and picks up the can he hit as if this can had legs, we'd be eating good tonight.
Oh, my God.
Then he stumbles upon the body thinking that he shot this man.
Oh.
So, as soon as he starts trying to figure out what to do, people start showing up, this dead body. Lady comes along discovering him, also resulting in a great exchange of lines, one of which Hitchcock named as just a favorite line of his delivery, where she casually walks up and says something to the effect, so what's up? He thought the line read was perfect. Like, oh, great. But they talk a little bit, go back and forth. She ends up asking him out on a date for later that night.
Oh, so, yeah.
Gives you an idea of where this movie's going. The next guy to show up is a book reader who's wandering along carrying a book, trips over the body, thinks nothing of it, stands up and keeps walking. Doesn't even look back to see what he tripped on. And then, of course, we've got the Forsythe, who comes along and is an artist and needs to figure out how he's going to do some sketching. And he wants to go out in the woods to sketch, finds the body and sketches the guy's face, which leads to problems later on. Sam then meets Jennifer, played by Shirley MacLaine. And again, the lines are just gorgeous. It's this great, almost noir level, amazing lines of people just saying stuff that nobody in real life ever actually says, but who cares? Cause it sounds so damn cool. Like one of the lines that ended up on the poster is in this one where she asks John, so did you see him? And she says, when I saw him, he was dead. Her response, he looks exactly the same except vertical. It's just like this casual shit that's just thrown out constantly. It's a wild, strange, almost a stage play level movie. This is one of Alfred Hitchcock's least tricky films. He doesn't do any crazy shots. He doesn't do any weird movements of actors. It's very much set up, do your stuff, move to the next scene, set up, do your stuff, which makes it kind of interesting. It's short on plot. I mean, that what I just described is kind of the whole movie. It just escalates in weirdness as they like have to keep reburying and re-digging up the body and all this weird stuff happens. It's just, it's a fun film. It is a lot of fun to watch. It is very different for Alfred Hitchcock. I couldn't imagine if you thought, oh, I want to find out who Hitchcock is. So I'll watch, what's this one? Let's watch this. It would be very weird then they go on to the rest of his catalog. Like, I love this style movie. I must see all this. Oh, tagline, a comedy about a corpse. A thriller with a difference. Somebody pulled a croak job.
Oh, boy.
A different kind of kick the bucket comedy. That's so bad. There's a bunch of these. It's about a man who won't stay dead. His widow who won't stay single.
Oh, my God.
Red, gold, and glorious. The full flavor of autumn in Vermont. The unexpected from Hitchcock. So Hitchcock being, you know, the kind of shithead he was, contacted the writer as like with anonymously to buy the book rights for $11,000.
Oh.
So,
as opposed to, I'm sure if he'd said, hi, I'm Alfred Hitchcock, I want to buy your book, there probably, even at that time, might have been another zero behind that. So this was an experiment for Hitchcock where he wanted to see how audiences react to non-star driven movies. So none of these people at that time, although we know several of them now, they were kind of just actors or complete unknowns at the time. And he didn't want, so he thought he'd see, what is this going to be like? And how will the U.S. react to a very British style humor? The humor in this is very dry most of the time, even though it is campy and weird. It's still just straightforward weirdness. We talked about that already. He didn't do any crazy shots. This movie was unavailable for 3 decades because it, along with 4 other movies, including Rope, Rear Window, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and Vertigo, were put in kind of a stasis for his daughter to release to make money from when she was ready to, for Patricia Hitchcock. So they're known as the 5 Lost Hitchcocks. They eventually came out sometime, I believe, in the 80s. They were finally released and put out again. So like I was saying earlier, the heavy rainfall was so bad, they constructed some of the sets inside a local high school gymnasium and shot a lot of them there. And I'm about to run out of time. Let's see, anything else here? Jerry Mathers appeared 2 years before Leave It to Beaver.
Oh, very good. Very good.
This is a movie. I don't remember a lot of it. I just remember what you were saying. I think I went into this going, okay, let's see what this is about. And I had no idea that he'd done like a comedy before.
Yeah. I could have written down another dozen lines that were just this fun, clever,
yeah,
interesting to listen to, which I miss that so much in movies. That's why part of the reason I go back and watch noir films,
right,
like The Maltese Falcon and some of those others where you just get to have these rich, like Brick, as far as a semi-modern lines that, you know, this didn't sound real. Real people don't talk like that. It's like, so what? It's a fucking movie. Real people don't do most of the things people do in movies.
Wow. Okay. this means that I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm, that next week we're doing Micah's subgenre, which was Southern horror.
Yes. I believe it was Southern horror.
Yep. So good. Thanks to Micah and Jason, who sent in some thank yous to us in the form of some pizzas.
Oh.
There. So if Jason, if you're interested or I missed a message from you, feel free to reach out again and go, hey, you know what might be cool? Let us know.
Thank you so much, Jason. And of course, Micah, I already know what I'm doing for Southern.
Oh, do you?
Snap.
Nothing.
No, don't tell us.
If you would like to have us choose a subgenre, all you got to do is what, Eric?
Reach out. Send. We like, you know, a little donation's good. We're running a little low in our kitty recently. But we also will take shares and thank yous and other things.
Thank yous. Yeah, all of that.
Feel free
stuff
to do weird stuff like we've got Carlos out there who takes the image that I make for each of the movies that has the three posters.
Right.
And he guesses which one of us has which movie.
Right.
He started off on a really hot streak, but boy, he's gotten cold. I expect to see a return to form here soon, Carlos.
I think the more that he's known us and gotten used to us, the less that he actually knows us.
It's all adding up.
So if there's something funny, interesting, or strange thing you want to give a try, feel free. Enjoy.
Yeah, and also, if you would like to call us and leave a voicemail, the number for that is 253-237-4266. Tell us your name. Let us know if we can use your message online, and we will play it. We really love that kind of stuff. So that's it, right, guys? We're coming back in 7 short days. We're talking Southern horror.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. We'll see you then.
Transportation and other considerations for Strange Eons Radio produced by Pan Am Airlines. When you think of traveling, think of Pan Am. You can't beat the experience. Guests of Strange Eons Radio stay at Econo Lodge Everett. It's an easy stop on the road, if you know what I mean. Strange Eons Radio is recorded live in front of a studio audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Sit, Ubu, sit.
Cool. What's a craw? Like a crawdad?